FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's June 20th, 2017. There is trouble in the land down under. Is the Gold Coast losing its shine? Well, what about the real estate market in Australia? They're bringing new meaning to creative finance. That oil plunging, what's going to be with the banks that are underwriting this, the oil companies, where is the price of oil going to stop? Well, Danielle Park of JugglingDynamite.com is with us now. And oh, before we start, email us at kl@kerrylutz.com. Hey, Danielle, it's another day in paradise.
Well, yeah, sure it is. you know, the great facade of the central bank injections that have lasted for the last 8 years is really fraying at the edges in all these markets all at once. If you look at that, you know, it's about 15 trillion bucks, give or take, trillion that has been pumped in since something like 2007. This artificial capital has really been price indiscriminate, flowing everywhere. And it has done things like buoying asset values, like revamping the prices in the U.S. housing market, for example, after the collapse. You know, it helped investor flows into that space, which rebounded prices, which brought back the bond portfolios and loan portfolio values for the banks that, you know, allowed other people to get refinance that couldn't unless the values had come back. You know, it buoyed some of the financial assets that people then levered off of, that the banks then traded off of. So really, I see that flow of capital just flooded all over the world. And the same thing happened in the Australian market in real estate as happened in the Canadian market. You know, it's always at the edges got a little bit of truth to the thesis, which is that there was an exodus of capital leaving China, and that it was just as the Japanese capital did after the bubble burst in the late 80s in Japan. It flooded all over the world and bought up everything with a voracious appetite, driving prices higher, making it unaffordable for locals, you know, making it unsustainable for real working people, and therefore, you know, no connection to incomes in the country. So that's happened, you know, in so many places around the world in the last 8 years. Australia being close to China has really been just at the fire hose, you know, end of that capital gushing. And it has driven, you know, prices like beyond madness. I thought Canada is really bad too. We have debt to disposable income of about 169% right now. But in Australia, the latest data is it's over 200% debt to disposable income in households. So they're even worse. And, you know, what's a particularly shocking stat there is that almost 40% of the home loans there are interest only, which means in that particular case that there are people only have to make interest payments for 5 years. And then at the end of that period, they either have to refinance or they have to begin paying principal. So if you think about that, even if rates don't go up, Kerry, even if they were to stay flat or stay here for the rest of our known existence, the fact is that people have to at some point start adding some principal payment in there. And that's where this really comes to a screeching halt, because the cash flow has not grown commensurate with these price gains, and incomes can't afford it. And, you know, everyone's piled all this money that they could scrape up into housing at these ridiculous valuations. It's still just their shelter. They still need to live. They still need funds for everything else. And that's the stuff that they don't have. And they haven't been saving for retirement. And, you know, round and round it goes. So again, back to, we got this big hit of central bank liquidity to supposedly save the system in 2008. Mm-hmm. But what it's really done is extend and pretend another nearly a decade now, and bring everyone to that much further down the speculative pipe to financial disaster. You know, I call it financially suicidal behavior. That's what we've seen now for the last decade.
Yeah, that's hard to believe. Extended and pretend has been around, Danielle, for nearly a decade. It was an emergency measure, you know, the suspension of that FASB rule 157, I think you said before it was, temporary. And here we are, nothing's getting marked to market. I will tell you that the banks made out like thieves from the reinflation of the real estate market because they had valued those mortgage-backed securities literally at zero. In fact, they couldn't value them because there wasn't a market for them. And then the Fed started buying them. Then the real estate market magically picked up. And now, because they've written off their basis on these loans, Danielle, forget it. I mean, they are just crushing it on those on the mortgage-backed securities. And you know what, Danielle, what I read recently, and I know you read it as well, they continue to securitize everything in sight. Nobody's learned anything from any of this, Danielle, that securitization can be a problem at times, right? It can be very destructive to the financial system, and yet nobody seems to understand.
You know, it sounds good in theory, I guess. I go back to, you know, very early on in my career, Enron and WorldCom were the poster children for off-book liabilities and, you know, hiding debts and turning them into assets by prestidigitation or financialization. In the end, of course, spectacular blow-up, bankruptcy, lawsuits, criminal investigations, people arrested, thrown in jail, you know, a franchise that had been around for decades destroyed, jobs lost, pensions bust. I mean, but instead of learning, hey, that's a very dangerous cocktail we have to avoid and we have to try and put some rules in place so that doesn't replicate, what ended up happening was they took from the, you know, Greenspan and Company's bailout of that sort of, well, first of all, from, you know, in the late 80s with Citibank and then long-term capital and then, you know, Enron and WorldCom, every time they got backstopped, the message was, hey, we can go do this on scale somewhere else. And literally it went countrywide, worldwide. So we've had this very toxic model. It's all about bringing profits forward, gouging out capital, selling yourself to the stock market to unsuspecting investors, you know, using inflated shares to buy other companies, you know, massaging and managing and magically maneuvering all your financial information to make it look like you don't have as much leverage as you do, which all looks great in the upcycle and everyone could go, oh, prices are going up, great. Except the problem is the carnage is catastrophic in the end. And this is what I mean. This is literally a fatal strategy because the institutions, the participants, the companies, if they didn't get their money out early, like many of the executives did, they end up literally going bankrupt. So it all looks great and sexy in the short run, and it's catastrophic to long-term stability and health. It's been undermining the world economy for the last 20 years, making us more and more fragile, less and less productive, less and less innovative in many ways, with all this malinvestment, capital flowing to the wrong things. It's like a big game. It's about tricking people instead of full disclosure.
Yep, you're exactly right. And eventually the piper's got to get paid. Eventually the emperor's state of dress or lack of dress is going to be understood by the serfs. And then forget it. It's ain't going to be pleasant, is it?
Well, the other thing is that, you know, we can look at Japan, and I guess we really should have all known that this human propensity to want to cover up and continue this charade is very ingrained. I guess it's human nature if it's allowed to go to this extreme. But we saw it in Japan. We saw that they pretended and extended, tried all the QEs, didn't acknowledge all their bad debts after their bubble from the 1980s. Luckily for them, they were a wealthy economy by the time their bubbles burst. So they had a high household savings rate, as an example. China, on the other hand, being the exact replication of these ideas on a national scale over the last 15 years, unfortunately, they did so and went, you know, they've gone bust before they've got wealthy. So the household wealth in that country, the average income, all that sort of thing, is still very much in developing world stage. Other than this tiny percentage of the population that has been able to gouge capital out and now has been throwing it around the world, creating mayhem for the rest of us in terms of affordability in our main staples like housing. But so China, you know, has gone bust. In truth, it has gone bust. It has has been hiding it and, you know, doing all these same strategies to try and lever on lever and keep the game going. But the credit impulse globally has turned down, led by China over the last year. So there comes to a point, I think there's two things there. Like I said, the population is old, aging in China, and still not well off. They don't have very much household savings. They have money in stock market bubbles and housing bubbles, which, as you know, have been mean reverting and causing mayhem, but they don't have actual cash savings or good income levels still. The second thing that's major different this time than it was in the 80s with Japan is the rest of the world is now in this same predicament in various degrees. So when Japan blew up and money was flooding out into the rest of the world, they were really kind of literally an island unto themselves in that experiment, that maniacal experiment with leverage and leverage and leverage. The rest of the world really was not with them in that. So there was this, you know, potential for exports to other countries. There was other people we could buy goods off them, and they became that, you know, export juggernaut to bring cash flow in. And then they've continued to extend and pretend with their debt as well. But today we just don't have any real pockets of strength. I mean, Germany is sort of the pocket of strength because they've had relatively less asset bubbles, less housing, you know, excesses. But they still are requiring exports to keep their system afloat at this point. And that's where the Achilles heel comes in, because now that this flawed thesis of how to run companies into the ground has gone worldwide into how to run countries into the ground, we now have the world in this thing together and everyone looking for a lifeboat. So, you know, I think the good thing from my perspective is that we literally have run to the end of the edges of the planet in this madness. And there really isn't anywhere that's untainted that can run to the rescue unless we find another species on another planet who can come in and buy our stuff. So really, we have to work this out now. And I think when you can't extend any further, you have to start rationalizing, admitting the debts, putting them into, you know, entities where bad debts go to die, writing things off. You know, I did notice, for example, Carrie, did you see this, that the UK has just charged the former head of Barclays, executives of Barclays Bank from the 2007 disaster with fraud? So I know this is, you know, they may indeed hire a team of, you know, their $1 billion budget will no doubt defend them with a vengeance. But the fact is that this is something that's been lacking, this reconnecting with personal liability of offenders, directing minds of these corporations and institutions and, you know, government wings, everybody that's been doing pension managers, pension board members, as these pensions are going blowing up. Again, exactly the same reasons. It's all contagious. It's exactly the same thinking that has driven decisions at all these things. But as they're blowing up and as people realize the kitty's empty and as workers come for benefits they've been expecting that won't be funded, I think that's when you need to have, you know, this sort of clean house effect. And it's not until people realize they've lost that they get angry enough to insist on, you know, things like prosecutions. And then you do get sort of a curbing of this behavior. But so far, it's just been, you know, it's been passed off as intelligence and sophistication when in fact it's the opposite.
Well, there was a book out, I don't know if you had the opportunity to read it or not, called The Spider Network. And it was by a Wall Street Journal reporter. I have to look it up. But basically, do you know that the last financial disaster, only one guy went to jail, and it's this guy Thorpe, who was the trader for, he worked for Citibank, he worked for a whole bunch of too big to fail banks. And here is David Enrich, and I interviewed this guy, and this guy got 11 years because he was rigging LIBOR. And you know as well as I know, the banks knew exactly what this guy was doing, and he was rigging it just to make his own positions go higher. So he get, you know, he never got like zillions of dollars, but he was like, he was on his ascendant. He was on the ascendant. And this guy, Tom Hayes, is the only guy that went to jail. He got 11, originally got 15 years, and then they knocked it down to 11. And the reason why is because he fought them. He didn't just plead guilty. And they said, you know, you're fighting us, and That's, you don't want to do that. That's a big mistake. So they, you know, the guy is in jail and he can't believe he's in jail for what he did. Because put it this way, if the powers that be in these banks hadn't told him to go out and do it and engineered it themselves, they cheered him on when they realized what he was doing. And, you know, LIBOR was everything. So now they're not rigging LIBOR like they used to, I guess. They're not letting the traders do it. but this guy is rotting away in jail. The only guy, him and the computer programmer for Goldman Sachs, but eventually the Second Circuit said, you have to release him. There is no, he didn't steal any of your code. Let him go. But then the New York district attorney was after him. I don't know what's happened since then. But those are the only two guys. The guys who in many ways were probably the least responsible for anything that happened here. And what about the government officials who should be going to jail, sharing the cell, same cell with these guys, the revolving door and everything else? Well,
yeah, because, you know, here's the thing. The world is incredibly complicated now by all of the computer capacity and the rapidity of transactions, the quantity of transactions. So we have a truly new world in terms of, you know, all the moving pieces here. So we can do two things. We can abdicate all responsibility and let it all go to anarchy and suffer the consequences like we've been doing for the last decade. And boy, are we suffering the consequences. You know, another study recently from the World Economic Forum suggests that we've got something like by 2050, we're going to have probably $300 trillion of shortfalls in savings worldwide in terms of pension funds and 401ks and all the different places that people need money to make a civilized society function are going to be holding so many IOUs. And that's even from current asset bubble values. That's not even assuming we're giving back most of the gains we've seen in the past few years, which I think is a very faulty assumption to begin with. But yeah, so we can either, you know, abandon all effort and say it's hopeless, it's complicated, we must live in this horrific world of bankruptcy every other day, or we can say, well, we're going to have to curb it somehow. And the simplest and best way to curb it is to, as we've talked ad nauseum, sever the ability of taxpayers to be backstopping these participants and players who want to do reckless things, let them wear the weight of their own financial decisions, both financially and personally. So if they break rules, if their corporation breaks laws, they personally have to be held accountable. They personally have to have clawbacks of compensation, can't keep proceeds of crime, prosecuted for offenses, can't admit and can't pay fines without admitting and acknowledging their culpability. Like these just very simple things, just put those back in the system and it'll go a long way to correcting for much of this malfeasance.
And I think the regulators have got to be punished for their role in all this. You know, government is the great enabler here, Danielle. None of this could have happened without the government. And speaking of insolvency, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the state of Illinois and their impending. They can't go bankrupt in the U.S. States are not allowed to. So Congress will have to amend the municipal bankruptcy laws to allow states to go. But they will be insolvent and they have no ability whatsoever to solve their problems because that requires a massive write down of the state and municipal pension plans within Illinois. And their Supreme Court has said you can't touch the pension plans because of the state constitution. Many state constitutions have a clause in them that says no diminution of benefits from state pension plans. Like half a dozen, 14 of them have, 14 I think have it, the last time I looked. So
I saw a story today, LA Fire and Police Pension voted to lower its return assumption from 7.5 to 7.25. Like we're still in nut job area here. Now they're trying to tweak it towards, you know, more reasonable, which would be more in the maybe 2 or 3% target range, but they're still, you know, extending and pretending. Because once they do mark this down to a reasonable return assumption, the amount of deficit in that plan will, you know, compound over overnight. Oh, so,
yeah.
I think though, when it comes to collecting the checks, when it comes to, so far, you know, again, the leading edge of the boomers are into their 70s now. There's still, you know, many millions of people expecting to be getting a certain level of benefits in the next few years, both from private retirement accounts where their broker's telling them they can still, you know, make their dreams come true and they'll be able to achieve 6% and 7% rates, which is totally overselling what's realistic in this environment. So from private savers to the few pensions that are around, they are not going to be able to make these ends meet. And then once people realize that, I think, you know, Danielle DiMartino Booth was saying in an interview recently that she thinks it'll end up in like a civil war of sorts. Once people, social unrest, once people realize, I mean, it's wild.
They have to. I mean, look, it can't end any other way. You got millions of people who are promised things. And that's not just the government employees. That's every level of society and
the world over.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, Western all the world, developed world.
The Western world is all in the same boat. So they almost have to import all these refugees to expand the labor force and work cheaply to pay this thing. But the point is, it can't be paid. It's not going to be paid unless they just inflate all value out of their currencies. It's the only way that they can be paid. And then in the U.S., we have the thing of, should the federal government rescue a state? Now, up until recently, the answer would probably be no, the state can work it out on their own. I think we're getting to a point where it becomes, all right, if the federal government does it, and then there's 20 states behind Illinois, what's to, you know, that's the end of the currency, I think. I don't see how the federal government bails them out. So then the only thing to do really is to take all these plans, Danielle, cash them out, and basically terminate them like they did in the private sector, all these defined benefit plans, because the defined benefit plans just to have real problems with them when you have dishonest bookkeepers, which the government has been.
It goes full circle because it is not that that these plans are impossible. It's that you have to fund them sufficiently to make A plus B equals C, right? Nobody wants to put in enough contributions or savings. The individuals themselves don't either. They don't want to hear that they have to cut back on consumption or that they can't afford the house or car that they have because they should be saving more for retirement, as an example. So there's that aspect to it. But also, you know, the people that sit on the boards of these plans, you know, the people in governments, no one wants to hear that we can't spend at the level, we can't expect consumption to build at that rate indefinitely, at this targeted rate indefinitely, because we can't afford it, because we can't keep adding more debt on debt. And the pay down period requires a downturn in consumption. And since no one wants that, that's why we've got into this, you know, 30 decades of finding ways to kick the can and add debt and goose consumption. Well, we've come to the demographic end of that propensity. We've come to the financial end of that propensity. Because the debt is circling the globe, the overhang, even just paying the interest, never mind having rates go up, never mind, you know, anything, just trying to service what we've got, just trying to take income from assets that are yielding the least in 50 years because the prices are too high. So, you know, I think at some point, I do think the good news in this story is that this always was a very destructive road. It was able to continue much longer than any rational person might have thought possible. But the good news is that at the final bang, when you literally can't keep that game going any longer, you start getting to solutions. And solutions mean all of the above. It means, you know, resolution. It means breaking down debts. It means writing off bad assets. It means lowering expectations of payout. It means, you know, picking up, working longer. It means lowering expenses for households. In other words, back to things like, how do you lower your utilities cost? How do you lower your transportation costs? You know, what can you do to make more, to get more out of less? Because there's two ways to increase wealth. It's to make more and to need less.
Yes.
Right. So we're going to focus now on the needing less part, not on being destitute and living on the street, but how to be more efficient and how to get by without wasting as much as we've wasted in in the last 30 years when debt was freely available. Because let's face it, debt engenders weakness and bad choices frequently in human beings. It's just our nature. It's what we do. We've got enough history to know. We've seen this throughout biblical times. We've seen this, you know, every 30 years or so, we've seen this. But today we have it worldwide. And I think that's a function of the fact that we had groupthink from academic institutions, directing minds of all these bodies around the world, all digested the same theories and textbooks, regurgitated the same flawed concepts, contaminated everywhere. And as well, at the same time, you have worldwide media, worldwide financial institutions, worldwide markets, and the internet. So all this together allowed everyone to be infected with this mania at the same time. So I think now the good news is that we have an opportunity, as I say, in the bursting of this bubble, the everything bubble, the facade of that all of this was sustainable, which it never was. We now have a similar opportunity to use some of that global communication to quickly re-instruct ourselves with ideas and habits and change that can reboot the system. So I guess that's the positive that I look to coming out of what will inevitably be a very painful, disruptive time for many, many people.
Hey, and you know, Danielle, the miracle of it all is that it's gone on as long as it has. But we're obviously getting to a new phase here when you look at whole states. You know, Illinois used to be a prosperous state. The entire state bankrupt, insolvent. The largest city, third largest city in the country, Chicago, insolvent, bankrupt. And they're not alone by any stretch. They're just further down the rat hole. So
I think, you know, the number one thing we have to get here is great humility. I think we have to reconnect back to productive pursuits and humility, not getting money for free, money for nothing. You know, none of this. We're the best in the world. That's something Americans say. And every time I hear it, I think, how are we measuring this? The best country in the world. Well, sorry, guys, but that comes off fairly obnoxious to other folk, let me tell you, because really, how are we measuring any of this? We've all succumbed to similar problems, similar bad choices. So I think, you know, instead of who's the best of the best, we should really focus on who's the smartest, who's the most efficient, who can remake themselves and find, you know, good in this bad and really get back to a sustainable
Absolutely.
System.
Hey, there was a time when the U.S. was the best. There's no question about it. But I think that time has long since come and gone. And now we need to get back to problem solving, try to be a little proactive, not wait for the ultimate collapse to occur first. But I don't, the more I watch this thing, Danielle, the less I believe that's going to happen. In any event, we got to wrap it up now, so check out Danielle's work over at jugglingdynamite.com, our site, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Sign up for a newsletter, and while you're at it, if you want to send an email, kl@carrylutz.com. Danielle, we will catch you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.